A man walks into the village pub and says, "Number four," and everyone falls about laughing. Next, a woman sitting over in the corner hollers, "Seven!" Again, the whole place erupts in laughter. And so it went for a couple of minutes, people randomly calling out numbers. The stranger sitting in the middle of the room had just moved to the village. He was a bit bewildered and didn't understand entirely what was going on, but he knew his numbers, and he wanted to join in the fun. 23, he shouted out with glee, just waiting for the laughter to welcome him as a member of the crowd. The rest of the folks just stared back at him until someone said, "Son, that one hasn't been funny for years, and it's a little inappropriate that you've brought it up now, given recent events, don't you think?" Some jokes, some stories are so well known, so loved, that they hardly need telling. Except that there's bound to be someone who doesn't know the story yet. That's certainly true of our biblical stories. The vignette from the road to Emmaus is one of the best known and most dearly loved of all the Christian stories, not least because the truth of it has been revealed in most of our lives. And even in the narrative itself, it alludes to the fact that we presume everyone knows the story. We remember the two who were walking along said to the Jesus that they didn't recognize, "Haven't you heard? Don't you know? Are you the only one in all of Jerusalem who doesn't know the story?" But that doesn't mean that we should stop telling the story just because we think everybody knows it. And although for many of us, merely speaking the words Emmaus Road is enough to transport us or be an indication to us to it's code language for saying we need to recognize the risen Christ all around us, or to get us reflecting on where we have seen Jesus in the past day or weeks or on our way to church, it's nonetheless an important exercise to tell the story, to read the story. Because the retelling of it, the reading of it, preaches each time to our weary and sometimes jaded places. Like a piece of artwork that we've looked at perhaps 1,000 times, it finds ways to speak to us in different ways depending on how the light of our life's current circumstances happens to glance off it at that particular moment. Most of you are aware that yesterday was the launch of Oxford's month of Art Weeks. And over the years, a number of members of our congregation have participated in Art Weeks. This week I know that Christine Bainbridge is, as she does most years, and Siobhan has in previous years as well. And one of the beauties of Art Weeks is that these artists often, not always, sometimes they set up their displays in places other than their homes, but often the artists open up their very homes to share their artwork, the work of their hands, inspired by the Spirit, to express God's place in their lives, whether they represent it that way or not, I wouldn't presume to say. But I know that some of the artists in our congregation do feel very strongly that their works of art are an expression of God's life in and through them. And so by opening up their homes, they are also welcoming the public and any who care to visit to see a bit more about themselves as an individual and the way in which God moves and lives in their own dwelling place and how they express themselves more fully, not just in their artwork, but in their home. One of the other wonderful things about Art Weeks being an opportunity for people to go and visit numerous different places is that it gives people who go and survey the artwork an opportunity to interact with the artist themselves. They can ask questions about what inspired the art, inspired that particular image or sculpture or whatever their artwork is. Lots of them work with glass or textiles, or it is remarkable if you go and share in these artistic expressions to learn about what moves the artists to express what they have done with the media that they have used. Across the past years, a good number of you, perhaps even a majority of you here this morning, have gone across the road to see Siobhan and her artwork. Most of you are familiar with the fact that she's an iconographer, and you've probably seen the icon that she painted, this one, which is displayed regularly in our church. This was actually dedicated by Eddie Evans. He gave this as a gift to the church in memory of his wife. That is on display in the church. And Siobhan has brought a couple of other icons that she's going to be telling us about this morning. The worship ministry team thought it would be nice at the beginning of May, when all of Oxfordshire is appreciating artwork in general, to have someone in our congregation share a bit about their own ministry of art. And we have a significant number of talented artists among us, and so hopefully in time we'll have other artists share as well. But we're lucky and grateful this morning that Siobhan has agreed to share about her own work and her personal journey in life and faith and art. And so we welcome her right now to the front to share a piece of her story and her work with us.
Thank you very much, Tanya. Can I stand on this?
Oh, yes, of course.
Might be easier. Thank you very much for asking me here this morning. My little talk is about as much as my personal journey through life as about how I paint and why I paint. First, a matter of technical matter. I would like to say that many people use the term to write an icon, not to paint. But this morning I'm going to use the word paint, perhaps because that's more what I feel I do. To start with, I'll tell you a few anecdotes. I was brought up in County Tipperary in Eire in the 50s. Where I went to a Catholic convent. And my first experience of religious art came as a small child, I think I was age 7, at my first communion, sitting in a cold church, bored and fidgeting. The nuns in charge had promised the devil would jump on my shoulders if I giggled or looked round. So I looked upwards instead, and there were Victorian paintings on the walls and ceilings, and I marvelled that someone could paint heaven and angels, the Virgin Mary, the saints, the crucifixion, in the same place where the devil was waiting to jump on my back. Fast forward to a blue stocking girls' school on the south coast of England. This school eclipsed St Trinian's at every possible form of bad behaviour. The Department of Education, in the films, failed to close down St Trinian's. But they did manage to close down this school. And on the last day of prize giving, Margaret Rutherford had been produced to give out the prizes. I won the art prize, and I remember walking up through the damp, soggy rose garden to collect my prize. The headmistress, who actually did look very like Alistair Sim, and Margaret Rutherford had been drinking sherry since morning assembly. And as their chairs sunk into the damp lawn, combined with the sherry, neither of them could stand up. So I had to bend down and rifle under their deck chairs to find my prize. And it was a book on Byzantine art. I still have it. The text of this book was much beyond me at the age of 13, but the wonderful illustrations that ancient artists painted with gold always stayed with me. Time moves on. Art school, marriage, wonderful children, a teaching career. I remember reading A Day in the Life of an Icon Painter. What a wonderful thing to be. But how on earth did one learn to be an icon painter? Even if I could have found out then, there was no time left in my busy day. But unseen hands guide. When we moved to Wheatley, our family was lucky enough to have Tilly Covell as our immediate neighbour. Tilly became my greatest friend, and soon after we arrived, Tilly said, "I'd like you to come to church with me. The United Reformed Church couldn't be nearer, just across the square." and they're all very nice people. We're very lucky in this village. And she was quite right. The URC is opposite, and you are the kindest people. And it is the kindness of this small community has helped me immeasurably, from shared worship on Sundays to the first art week I held here in the church. Many visitors were very impressed that I was showing Orthodox icons in a United Reformed Church. I heard comments such as, "Such broad vision, quite unusual." But all the people who visited were impressed by the beauty of this little church and its kind and gentle atmosphere. Then 3 years ago, Tanya organised an exhibition in the chapel at Mansfield College, and that was an honour indeed. I don't think I'm alone when I say it's that to explain what means much to me is really quite difficult to put into words. So in a roundabout way, I'm getting there slowly this morning. First, I'll say a little bit more about my journey and the technicalities of painting in tempera. Some 12 years ago, and I'm sure lots of people have heard this anecdote before, I went to collect my youngest daughter from a school friend's party, and I found myself waiting in a long hall illuminated by a 60-watt bulb. It was one of the college houses tucked away in a small alley. I think the mothers were quite sort of important professors somewhere of some college. And as my eyes got used to the gloom, I saw the walls were lined with the most wonderful collection of icons. And I asked I asked Annie's little friend's mother about her collection. And I said that I would really like to own an icon of my own. Where did she get them from? And she replied that she'd put me in touch with her dealer. Well, I was so impressed that people should buy such things. By return of post, a remarkable catalogue arrived. And each wonderful icon had a price tag that ended in 3, if not 4 noughts. Sadly, no icon for me. So I decided to paint my own. Where do I start? With a book on how to paint icons. Well, that was a start. And then I found a better book on the techniques of tempera painting. Next, I met some excitable Russians who shed little light on the mystery. They preferred to give their saints Disney eyes and mawkish expressions in the hope this would appeal to Western buyers. But luck does reward persistence. And visiting an elderly friend, I met a lady who told me she painted in tempera. So I asked her if she would teach me. Well, she was a little taken back at this request, but she said yes, if I could go to see her in Cambridge. And when I arrived at her studio, I realised that I invited myself around to spend the day with one of the most respected restorers of early Renaissance art. A very humbling experience. She was kind as herself, and in a day introduced me to the traditional techniques she used for all the major world art galleries and museums, the techniques of tempera painting and water gilding. And it was a wonderful experience to be finally shown how things should be done properly and not from half-baked books. Now the hard work started. I had to go away and perfect what I'd been taught, something I've been doing ever since. So that is one side of my journey up to this point in time. I think I need to explain a little of the technicalities of painting in tempera, because in many ways they're entwined with the spiritual. When you paint with tempera, each stage of making an icon must be perfect, absolutely perfect, or what follows is always wrong. Each stage of the making, for instance, the wood must be dry and well sanded. Any bumps will ruin the gesso that has to be applied at exactly the right thickness and temperature. The drawing underneath the painting must be perfect, no indecisive lines. Halos ought to be round. The tempera must be painted at a perfect mix and applied from dark to light, building up layers of pigments suspended in a fragile layer of translucent egg yolk. One can't fudge tempera, as I might fudge a painting if I'm using oils or the fluidity of watercolours. It has to be right the first time, true to itself. What is most difficult is to communicate the spiritual side of icon painting. I'm sure that there are many specialists who can tell at a glance the provenance and the value of an icon. They could say who and how and where it was painted, something I only ever find out very late in the day, or by accident. Some icon painters fast and repeat prayers. I prefer silence, the birds singing in the garden, and with luck, nobody in the house. But for me, an icon is a conduit of something I do not fully understand. I can sense the presence, and I know when I'm painting if it is with me or not. And if it is not with me, then I have to wipe the whole thing, clean the board, and start again. And when it works, something happens. I managed to describe this to a friend once as, when the spirit shares its soul, a light comes into the eyes, the skin breathes, in a way, there is life. Today, I bought a copy of Rubiloff's Trinity. It's here, so I don't think anybody there can see it, but everybody can have a look afterwards. I bought it as an example of... Oh, you could, yes, that would be great. Quite heavy. Might crash. That's really kind of you. Yeah. I painted, copied this a couple of years ago. It's half size. The real one is exactly double the size, and it's in, I can't pronounce the name of the Russian museum it's in, but it's in Moscow. And Rubiloff was one of the world's greatest icon painters. He worked in Russia in the 14th century. And sometimes I feel when I copy an icon, for tradition has it, that they should be copied as perfectly as possible. When I retrace the paint strokes, I can feel some of what the original icon painter was experiencing. Perhaps the brush strokes are stressed and hurried. Perhaps they're exploring and confident. But I think it's possible to catch an attitude, a state of mind from the original painter. And some of the best icons, I'm sure, are portraits. People that the icon painter knew and perhaps loved. Others are handsome, slickly painted products of a long-ago icon studio. Painting the Rubiloff Trinity was enlightening. Only then did I realise how beautiful, how perfect his drawing is. The lines he used to define the angel's earthly form are in their own way celestial, drawn with precision, economy and perfection, ultimate surface tension. Underneath the robes are bodies that can live and breathe, wings that can soar. If you just look at it, it is so understated, and yet when you look at it hard, you can just feel the beauty of it. The perfection is utterly truthful, and that truth is the definition of beauty to me, something touched by heaven. For me, these angels are alive, living beings, peaceful, yet fey, and so powerful that in any second they could, at will, take flight and disseminate, vanishing into the ether. As a last effort to define the truth of beauty and the divine, I'll tell you a short story. Are you happy there for a few more minutes? Yes? Yep, yes. I'll tell you a short story. Alan and I have visited Greece several times. A few years ago, we went to Mystra on the Peloponnese. Mystra is a ruined Byzantine town built on the steep mountainside looking down over Sparta and the plays of Arcadia towards the sea. It is one of the most beautiful places on earth. We arrived there late in the day. All the tourists had left, and we walked down through the winding Byzantine streets, looking in at the churches and houses. And some of the churches still had wonderful Byzantine frescoes in their ruins. The cathedral had real icons on its walls, and the air smelt of incense and dust. And the warm sun was sitting behind us. And we came to a monastery, and looking through a crumbling stone arch festooned with honeysuckle and jasmine into the courtyard. From inside, a nun was singing while she cooked, and washing hung from a window, and a cat nursed her kittens in the last of the golden sun. And for a few seconds, or perhaps it was a lifetime, in that place, the beauty and the peace and the absolute truthfulness, time was suspended, and there in the ancient courtyard I felt heaven touch earth. Yet I don't think this experience of heaven touching earth is only to be found in the perfection of Rubiloff's icon or in distant and exotic places, but it can be found just opposite my house, across the square, with kind people and a shared peace and worship. And this might go a little way to explain why I paint. I do hope so. Perhaps at the end of the service, if you'd like to ask me any questions, otherwise we could be here for a while. And the Devlins have brought an icon I painted for them. And last of all, if you would like to come to my house any time this morning, there's a few things up that I've painted in the last years. I'm not doing Art Week. But anyhow, thank you very much.